Hello, I'm Matt Kundle, and this is number 0564, the Stuff Out program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0564. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on to talk about the SpaceX launch that put American astronauts into space from American soil for the first time in 9 years, thanks to private enterprise.
It was 2011, final flight of the shuttle, STS-135. So we wound down that program with the expectation that within 4 or 5 or 6 years, we'd be flying on private rockets. So the whole idea was, look, the shuttle's very expensive, it's getting older. It was always kind of risky. It wasn't as safe as we had hoped. And it was very costly. It was, depending on how you parse the numbers, about $1 billion or $1.5 billion per flight. So we wanted a cheaper way of doing business.
Mystery writer Anne Charles, who has the latest novel in her Deadwood series, it's the 11th book. This one is called Devil Days in Deadwood.
The heroine's a single mom. She has twins. She's a realtor. Just moved into Deadwood, South Dakota, which has a lot of history and always a lot of ghosts. Anyone who goes to Deadwood will hear the ghost stories. So that's how it kind of all started. And with the first one, there's little girls that have gone missing. They look a lot and are the same age as her own daughter, Violet Parker's daughter. So Violet kind of gets pulled into this all, and it starts the whole thing rolling as she digs in because she wants to know what's happening to the little girls so nothing happens to her own.
Tedium's Ernie Smith is back with the history of the all-you-can-eat buffet.
I think that most people, when they think about it, they think about it in terms of restaurants like Golden Buffet or Ponderosa Steakhouse, but it actually has some pretty deep roots in Las Vegas. In the 40s, one of the early resorts in Vegas, El Rancho Vegas Resort, they tried to offer a service to gamblers who were up late and needed something to eat. They basically put out a bunch of meats, a bunch of cheeses. It really took off from there. And buffet culture, at least until now, has been pretty big in Vegas over the years.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0564, is a former radio colleague of mine, Matt Kundle, who runs Matt Kundle Media Incorporated and is the host of the excellent The Sound Off podcast. If you have any interest whatsoever in radio or podcasting or both, this is a show you might want to check out. And if you're setting up your podcast and you want more information or some help, perhaps you should get in contact with Matt at Matt Kundle Media Incorporated. He won't steer you wrong. And you'll find the link to Matt's website by just going to the show for this number, which you just heard him say. See how it all goes full circle? Thank you very much, Matt, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? With the border shut tight over the last little while, it doesn't seem to make sense that this would be a good time to do any smuggling. But it seems a Canadian was caught at the border with 51 live turtles stuffed down his pants. Oh, dear Lord, I hope they weren't snapping turtles. He is now facing charges in the U.S. over an alleged reptile smuggling operation. The U.S. federal court documents show officers with the Canadian Border Services Agency intercepted Kai Zhu as he attempted to cross into Windsor, Ontario from Detroit last month. During the secondary inspection, Zhu was found to have 51 live turtles taped to his person. Specifically, he had 41 turtles taped to his legs and 10 hidden between his legs. Oh, there are so many ways this could go wrong. Canadian authorities seized the turtles, which included North American varieties such as Eastern box turtles, red-eared sliders, and diamondback terrapins, some of which sell for $800 each. Canadian authorities turned them over to American officials. And this isn't even the first time Zhu has been caught with contraband reptiles. It is speculated that the cache was headed for China, where turtles are apparently prized as food or pets. Is that 51 turtles down your pants, or are you just glad to see me?
That's why I love turtles.
Yeah, you'd really have to love them to do that. On May 23rd, German low-cost airline Eurowings resumed service between Dusseldorf and Sardinia, Italy. When the first jet arrived in the area, it couldn't raise the control tower at the airport in Sardinia. It was closed for the pandemic and wasn't going to be open until at least June the 2nd. After waiting in a holding pattern while trying to figure out what to do, because circling the airport in a holding pattern for about 9 days definitely was not in the cards, the flight crew decided to make the 1,170-kilometer trip back to Dusseldorf. Not too many passengers were inconvenienced, though. There were only two on board. Eurowings blamed the gaffe on a misunderstanding in the consolidation of the relevant flight information. Wow, that's a fancy way of saying didn't call ahead. And after a report of a stolen trailer, Santa Rosa, California police located a pickup truck towing that trailer and attempted to stop it. The driver wouldn't pull over and a chase ensued, reaching speeds of 80 miles per hour. After a cargo dolly fell off and lodged under the trailer, the truck stopped and the driver, later identified as 42-year-old Aura Palmo, got out. She was armed with a cordless blower. She started the blower and it shot out a cloud of glitter covering the officers and passing cars. Palma was arrested, charged with reckless evading and driving a vehicle without the owner's consent. She could have also been charged with being fabulous. You do know that glitter will be on their uniforms longer than she'll be in jail. Glitter is the herpes of the crafting world. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, the bell means one thing. It's time to check the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
A 24-year-old man was killed after trying to blow up an ATM in Philadelphia. It was one of several incidents in which ATMs were vandalized, but the explosion outside Sidekick Sports Bar had deadly consequences. At least 10 ATMs were broken into. According to police, the man was using explosives and was seriously injured at the scene. He was taken to an area hospital and pronounced dead. Police said they found two M80s at the site of the ATM. So, instead of unlawfully taking cash out of the bank, this guy decided to make an early withdrawal from the planet. Because the Tree of Life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you. I am death.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Last week, we witnessed the dawn of a new era in American space exploration. SpaceX and Elon Musk delivered two astronauts to the International Space Station for NASA. It was a historic liftoff a week ago Saturday, with an equally smooth docking at the space station some 19 hours later. On board were astronauts Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken. To talk about the mission, we are joined once again by Rod Pyle. He's the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society, and the author of more than a dozen books, including First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Rod joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. I'm assuming that you not only watched the launch, but you watched the docking as well?
I watched the launch. I watched the non-launch a few days before. And I had to watch the docking later I had to miss that because I was actually moving. But I did track everything, and it's, you know, it's easy to say something is historic, and depending on which news outlet or reporter you were watching, it had either been 9 years or 11 years or 14 years since we had last flown humans from American soil. They seem to kind of be all over the place in their numbers. But it's not easy to overstate the historical significance of this, but it is easy to kind of not get the point exactly right. So depending on which news outlet you listen to, they said it's either 8 years or 9 years or 11 years since we last launched Americans from U.S. soil, and in fact, it's been 9 years. So it was 2011, final flight of the shuttle, STS-135, which I was privileged to attend. That was an exciting kind of lump in the throat moment. And that was 2011. So we wound down that program with the expectation that within 4 or 5 or 6 years, we'd be flying on private rockets. So the whole idea was, look, the shuttle's very expensive. It's getting older. It was always kind of risky. It wasn't as safe as we had hoped. And it was very costly. It was, depending on how you parse the numbers, about $1 billion or $1.5 billion per flight. So we wanted a cheaper way of doing business. So under the new Obama administration at the time, they said, let's set up this new arrangement with private industry, because NASA never really built its own rockets or spacecraft. They would design them in coordination with aerospace contractors and then hire those contractors to build them under very strict NASA supervision. And then once they were finished, these spacecraft were finished, they'd be turned over to NASA, and NASA would fly and operate them with other contractors supplying services. This was all done under what was called a cost-plus basis. So the contractor, say Boeing or Rockwell International or one of these companies, would bid to NASA, hey, we'll build your shuttle for $5 billion. No problem. I'm just picking that number out. I don't remember what they cost. Well, it would end up costing 8 or 10 or 15, and NASA would pay the difference because there were cost overruns. Under this new system of working with private industry, specifically for the human rides to the space station that we're seeing now with SpaceX and Boeing, the deal is, look, so NASA goes to these two contractors and says, look, you build it for this much, no ups, no overages. You better have a darn good excuse if there's any cost overruns unless we change something. And by the way, you own it and operate it, and we're buying rides from you. So that is really the most remarkable part of it. What's also remarkable for me, however, is you've got this stalwart, decades-old Boeing aircraft company. I think they were first formed in the 1920s, an aerospace giant. They're a monolith in the aerospace community who's been at this for the better part of a century. And then you've got this upstart SpaceX comes along in 2002 and says, yeah, we're going to build rockets and revolutionize the business. And they did. So they lit a major hot gas fire under Boeing, who's had to reduce their prices and change the way they do business along with the other aerospace contractors. And in fact, if you want to consider it a race, Elon Musk and SpaceX won the race because they got that first crewed flight up. And that's really exciting to me.
Now, I know Boeing is still in the game, and I have seen specs and taken a look at the inside of their spacecraft. And of course, I've seen the inside and specs of the SpaceX one, and it literally is night and day. The Boeing one, for lack of a better term, looks very antiquated.
Well, let's just say it looks more traditional. It looks little. I don't think the crew capacity is that different, but if you get inside, and I haven't been inside Boeing's Starliner, used to be called the CST-100. I have been inside the SpaceX capsule once for a few minutes, and it's big. It's not as big as the shuttle was inside, but it's large. You know, you sit in there with a couple other people, and you think, yeah, I could, and I have claustrophobia. So if I think it's large, it's large. And it's basically this, I saw it before it was finished, so I'm sure there's more finishing on the inside than there was, but it was basically pretty spare with this big glass control panel in front of the pilot, co-pilot, or in this place, in this current flight, co-commanders, with a few manual push buttons for critical things like retro rockets and parachute deploy and all that. But it's really just a big glass panel with a really sophisticated interface on it and a window and a hatch and a great big room. So it's kind of cool. And yeah, they really did reinvent how this is done. I think there's nothing wrong with Boeing's capsule design. but they flew it a couple months ago, and as I'm sure you know, had a number of major problems, mostly software related, but they had 61 individual defects that needed fixing, so they're going to have to fly it again at their own expense, and they made SpaceX look pretty good.
Yeah. Now, as I said, I watched the docking as well, which I found was pretty exciting. And, you know, the long process of pressurizing the space between where the docking is and where and inside the space station, it took a couple of hours. But it caught my eye when the two astronauts finally got into the space station was the immediate handshaking and hugging. And I thought, wow, they really have left Earth, haven't they? Because we can't do any of that.
Well, they had been quarantined for a week, and outside of the flight facility for a week or 10 days before that. So they were and they've been tested multiple times. So they were pretty certain they didn't have COVID. And of course, the guys have been up on the space station for a few months, so they didn't have it as far as anybody knows. But yeah, lucky them, huh? They get to sit up there and look down and go, "Yeah, you poor Earthling schmucks. Good luck."
Now,
I hope they didn't carry up any germs on the iridescent little sequin dragon they took along with them.
Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting about this particular mission is it could go anywhere from a month to almost 4 months, I understand. And part of the reason for that is wondering how long the SpaceX craft can stay in space and deal with all the rays that are hitting it?
Well, so it's interesting because it's only been tested, this particular version of it's only been tested once before with nobody in it. And whenever you've got a new spacecraft, you've got an array of new technology. So the electronics, they're pretty robust. They've been proven pretty well. The main area of concern, I think, are the seals on the valve bodies in the maneuvering thrusters. So usually you've got small thrusters on, let's go back to the Apollo or the shuttle days. You have these small thrusters that are hypergolic, so they have used two chemicals that meet and ignite on contact, no spark needed, and they thrust the spacecraft around. Those things have been used for years and were very well understood by the time the shuttle and the ISS were flying together. So we trusted them to stay up there for quite a while. The Soyuz spacecraft has been in use since the mid-1960s in one form or another. So we know that one pretty well. SpaceX is using a slightly different system, different way of doing business, because Musk likes to reinvent things the hard way, it seems, every time, which I admire. And so we want to make sure that those things will fire and behave correctly when the time comes. There is often a little bit of concern about heat shields because they go through hot cold cycles, but the space station is orbiting sufficiently quickly every 90 minutes that you don't have these long periods of what they call cold soaking and then long periods of sunlight. So my understanding is that they're a little less concerned about that because it doesn't get cold, 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 cold. You know, it gets a little bit cold and then heats up. So I think it's mainly the valve bodies.
We've got just about a minute. Is there anything, now that this has taken place, is there anything that you are giddy and excited about with the return of Americans to space from American soil, either with future launches of SpaceX or future launches of Boeing and SpaceX at the same time? What are you looking forward to?
Well, what I'm looking forward to is this continuing without any untoward mishaps and being an ongoing success. NASA's own internal studies, and this only applies to SpaceX so far, their internal studies and other government studies post the cost of doing business with SpaceX along these lines at between a half and a tenth of the old way of doing business. So another way to look at this in context is the entire program from beginning to end of developing the Crew Dragon through SpaceX has cost as much as two space shuttle launches. Just two of them. So that's a really good value for the American taxpayer. So it makes it more affordable for us, makes it something we can do more often, and it makes it so the entire world can join in and work with this company in this arrangement if they don't have their own launch vehicles and their own crew capsules and get in on the deal. And it's good for everybody.
Rod, it's always a thrill and a joy to have you on the program to talk about all things NASA. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you very much. Take care.
NASA expert Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, The Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Another one of his titles includes Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page number for this program, which is show number 0564, and you'll find links to Rob's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Ann Charles, the author of Devil Days in Deadwood, plus Ernie Smith from Tedium is back on the program to talk about the all-you-can-eat buffets. Are these going the way of the dodo thanks to COVID-19? We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and much more Stuff File news, so let's get right to it, shall we? A man called 911 for help at 1:30 a.m. He had crashed his SUV into a pond outside Elk Grove, California, and couldn't get out. No big worries, though. He was hauling a trailer, and it was keeping his SUV from slipping in further, so he apparently crawled into the back seat so he wouldn't drown, and waited for help. It took 48 minutes for rescue crews to find the man. He was indeed nose first into the pond, a liquid manure storage pond at a dairy farm. California Highway Patrol officers discovered the man had spent an hour trying to figure out how to get out before he indeed called for help. When the unnamed man was finally rescued at least 2 hours after going off the road, he was still drunk enough to be charged with DUI. Wow, that's one dedicated cop, considering he has to drive this guy to jail. Clearly, the driver was in deep doo-doo before he was arrested. Anyway, 47-year-old Tanya Cordero was arrested following a confrontation with a boyfriend. The confrontation between Cordero and her boyfriend was reportedly touched off when Cordero became upset when the man closed a window in her room. So, investigators allege, Cordero smashed hamburger in his face. When questioned by police, Cordero denied doing so, but her boyfriend still had hamburger in his ear upon arrival. Cordero made a comment that she hoped he choked on the burger. Charged with domestic battery, a misdemeanor, Cordero was later released from the county jail on her own recognizance. In January, she was convicted of battering her boyfriend during an October 2019 argument about one of their children's Halloween costumes. Sounds like a healthy relationship. He must have been pulling pumpkin out of his ear after that one. By the way, wouldn't you feel hamburger in your ear, and would you not feel compelled to remove it while waiting for the cops? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, another story dealing with relationships. A woman in Ghaziabad, India, recently went to a police station to complain that she had sent her son out to buy groceries only to return home with something unexpected. The unnamed mother said, "I sent my son to the grocery shopping today, but when he returned, he came back with his wife. I am not ready to accept this marriage." The woman's son, Gudu, said he married his wife Savita 2 months prior in Hardwar. However, it's unclear whether they actually tied the knot. Gudu said he and Savita couldn't obtain a marriage certificate in time due to lack of witnesses, so he tried to get one again in Hardwar, but was denied because of the COVID-19 lockdown. After returning from Hardwar, Savita stayed at a hotel in Delhi. Gudu said he decided to bring his new wife home after the hotel asked his wife to leave due to the lockdown. In order to solve the family squabble, police asked the owner of Savita's accommodations in Delhi to let the couple stay during the lockdown, proving once and for all that apparently the police and the hotel have far more compassion during these difficult times than the groom's mother. I'm guessing future gatherings at holiday meals will be out of the question? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Best-selling author Anne Charles has just released the latest novel in her Deadwood mystery series. This one is entitled Devil Days in Deadwood and joins us via Skype from Arizona. Hi, Anne. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Now, this is not the first. As I mentioned, this is a series of books. So how many Deadwood mysteries have you written?
The newest one is number 11. And I also have 5 Deadwood shorts, which are kind of like the backstory bits here and there of different characters that don't fit into the main series without slowing, you know, everything down. So they're off on their own, but they're all connected.
When you started this series, did you see it as a series or did it just grow into one?
It grew into one. When I first wrote it, it was a single title, but I ended it kind of with, you know, open-ended. And my agent at the time said, oh, we have a series here, a lot, you know, big series. And a lot has happened since then. And now I'm independent writing, no agent, but, you know, we were right. It's a big series. There's so much more to come.
So for those not familiar with the Deadwood series, what can you tell us about it and the characters involved?
It's a mixture of mystery, paranormal, humor, a little bit of romance in there, lots of supernatural suspense. So it's just a big mixed genre, fun series that's connected. It's not like where you read one and then you could skip to number 5. It's really, you know, you can read individually, you know, out of order, but it's a lot more fun if you follow the order and just see how the characters build. And the heroine's a single mom. She has twins. She's a realtor. She just moved into Deadwood, South Dakota, which has a lot of history and always a lot of ghosts. Anyone who goes to Deadwood will hear the ghost stories. So that's how it kind of all started. And with the first one, there's little girls that have gone missing, and they look a lot and are the same age as her own daughter, Violet Parker's daughter. So Violet kind of gets pulled into this all, and it starts the whole thing rolling as she digs in because she wants to know what's happening to the little girl so nothing happens to her own child.
Now, often when people talk about ghost stories or any stories where there are spirits, and usually the ghosts or spirits are saying, get out. No one gets out.
Right? I know. It's all the things. And a lot of times something will happen and Violet will say, you know, this is the point in the horror story where the crazy, you know, hero or heroine goes forth and I don't want to. I want to go the other way. So, yeah, I have a lot of fun. Like I said, there's humor throughout. That is a big part of my writing, a big part of my brand, if you will. All my series laced with humor because I think I handle hard times with humor. You know, it's how you get through. People choose different things to get through strife or whatever, pain. So humor is always my fallback. So I think that comes through on the page.
Writing is a very solitary profession, and you don't know how it's being received when you're writing it. So you've won multiple national awards, including the Daphne du Maurier for Excellence in Mystery Suspense. What does that mean to you after the fact, after the toil and trouble you go through to write a particular story?
It's extremely humbling. Every part of this, I started in 2011, January 2011 is when I released the first Deadwood. And the whole journey, all that's happened, it's surreal. It's humbling. I try not to focus on it too much because it makes me nervous and it'll shut me down. And I try to just live my little hermit life a lot of times and keep writing, just keep writing. And but I do worry with every release, what if this is the book that tanks me? What if this is horrible and I've lost my edge? You know, that's a, unfortunately, that's a constant worry for me. I wish I was more confident in my writing, but I just want to keep making the readers, I want to make them happy, have fun, even though a lot of the content is not always happy. I want them to finish a book feeling a little more uplifted, having laughed and cringed and winced along with me.
Now, you, this is a question I'm asking to all writers these days that I talk to. In this time that we live in of COVID and lockdown, how has that, if any way, shape, or form, affected your writing? Have you been able to write more? Have you been interrupted by your family more? How has that changed things?
Well, to be honest, I actually have gone from working about 8 hours a day to 12 because we don't take our kids to school anymore. You know, it's all been from home. We do grocery shop every 2 weeks usually. We just don't go out like we used to. So there's more time sitting in front of the computer and just writing away. My kids have grown up with this. I've been writing since the start, and their father writes too. We actually have a series together called the Deadwood Undertaker series that we write. And so now they're really used to living with two authors, and it means we are busy a lot writing. And so they're really good at entertaining themselves or playing with the cats or going outside. So it has affected, I mean, it's tougher because if you watch the news, there's a lot to be nervous about and scared and upset about out there. And writing humor through that, through these times, is not always easy. But again, I find that I fall back on humor to handle my fears, the tension, everything, using humor as kind of the source that keeps me calm. So in that way, I've been able to just hold up and keep going forward.
You've also co-written with your husband. You've written work by yourself.
Right.
How does that differ? The collaborative process as opposed to just your solitary process?
Well, it helps that for years, my husband has been behind the scenes brainstorming with me, helping me. He's one of my first editors. He's one of my toughest editors. So it really helps that he's been there all along, so that when we shifted into this where we work together, he kind of knew what to expect from me. He knew I was not always the easiest to work with. And it's really, you know, we've had kids together. We have remodeled our house together. And I will say that writing a book together was another whole level of that, trying to work through differences. But we've been together 20 years. So there's times when we walk away from each other and it's like, let's just cool down and think about this. And there's other times when we're just having so much fun collaborating and what if we do this? And I'll read something he wrote and be like, oh my gosh, I love what you did with this. This is so fun. And the same in return. So it's been different, but fun and sometimes challenging for both of us. But I love writing on my own. But then I also love sharing a story with him. So it's been an interesting couple years as we built this new series and got it going.
Now, you're a member of the Sisters in Crime and Western Writers of America, correct?
Correct.
And here in Canada, I know there's a group, I've interviewed them over the years, many, many years ago, the Women's Killing Circle, which is out of Ottawa.
Oh,
which are some mystery writers who are all women. And one of the questions I asked them at the time, oh, so many years ago, is what's the difference between a male mystery writer and a female mystery writer? And their answer was, female mystery writers usually feed their protagonists. There's a lot of eating going on and preparation of food. So I'll ask you the same question. What's the difference between a male and female mystery writer?
Oh, that's really interesting. They really nailed it. I hadn't even thought about that, but I do a lot of my, where I bring the character scenes, The kitchen of in the Deadwood series, it's her aunt's kitchen where they all group together. In the dig site series I write, it's the mess hall at the archaeological dig site. And at the in the Jackrabbit series, it's the bar. They all go to the bar all the time where they have food and stuff. So I had never thought about that. That's really interesting. I think there's there are some feels that are probably different. Women had come at things different. I think a lot of it seems there's I've read more character driven mysteries from females where men seem to have been more crime related, you know, it's they're focusing on that. Now, I'm not saying that's true across the board because I can't read all that much, but I do think we are a lot of times it's the characters we're developing these characters. And the crime is there as part of this book, but it's all about how the characters are handling it and growing. I see that more from the female writers I know. But again, I don't have a lot of time to read because I write, so I tend to watch more movies. And I don't know. I don't pay attention if that's, you know, written by a male or female a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of character development, now that you've got this ongoing series, and you said it started out as a one-off, but now it's become this series. Now that you're writing this series and it's an ongoing thing, do you know where your characters are going, or do you find out about what your characters are doing as you write?
I have a big overall series arc in mind. That doesn't mean it's set in stone. I allow things to shift along the way, but I do have where I'm going in the whole series in mind. Now, each book then has its own individual story arc. And so a lot of times I will start a story with plotting very loosely and knowing the beginning and knowing the midpoint and the end, you know, a good idea how I'm going to end this thing. And then I will allow my brain to have fun and play. And many things pop up along the way that shift. I often joke that I do this. If I try to do a full plot outline in detail, by the first turning point, I'm going in a different direction totally. So the plotting ahead of time is more to give me the confidence that I have a story that will come out. So let's just roll. But so I have ideas of where I'm going, but I do allow for much to happen along the way and try to shift with the changes as they come.
You write, your husband writes, do your kids write?
My son, he's 15 now. He's actually, he started a book, got about 20,000 words in and scrapped it because he realized he was using too much of an idea from someone else. And so he started over. And I think he's around 60,000 words now on a young adult sci-fi urban fantasy mixture. So he does. My daughter has played around with it, but that's just not her cup of tea. She wants to be a vet, so she'd rather try to surround herself with animals and beg me every week for a new animal. So she's not really there, but she is my marketing guru. She videos me for the stuff I do online and she will direct me. She's really good at going, "No, Mom, that was really boring. You got to liven that thing up a little bit, you know," or, "Oh, you looked a mess. Let's fix this and this." So she's my marketer. So I'm working on like TikTok. I want her to learn TikTok better so she can help me use that more as the future goes on with fun videos.
It sounds like with your family, this is a bit of a cottage industry, a family business.
Oh, man, we often joke in my whole big family because my sister is my bookkeeper. My brother does all the original art for my covers and illustrations. My sister-in-law is my assistant. She helps me. A lot of people are editing in my family. We often joke about before someone can come into the family, we have to vet them to see what they can offer to help. because we do, it is such a family thing for me. I have wonderful family that helps me so much, and that's huge in this business.
Well, the latest book in the series, the 11th, is Devil Days in Deadwood. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is annecharles.com, correct? And that's Anne without an E.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so annecharles.com. Thank you very much, Anne, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on here. This was a lot of fun.
Anne Charles, author of Devil Days in Deadwood. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0564, And you'll find links to Anne's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
On the air, on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about the history of the all-you-can-eat buffet and what future they may possibly have. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories to get to right here on the Stuff File program, so let's get right to it. In the UK, a naked man climbed through a house's skylight during a drug raid. He was still clutching cannabis as he scrambled onto the roof. Cocaine, scales, money, and his clothes were all left in his room. Officers executing a warrant sealed off escape routes and persuaded him to climb back inside. It is not known why he was nude. The South Devon Crime and Proactive Policing Team said he was quickly persuaded to return inside. Officers said, "This is taking social distancing too far." Devon Police Drugs teams say they have been relentlessly busy. Another person was arrested after 12 kilograms of cannabis worth £120,000 was seized last week. Officers also found £25,000 worth of cocaine inside a van stopped on the M5. The inside was covered in white powder after the driver tried to throw it out of a closed window. And two men have been jailed after cops busted a cannabis factory with the potential to produce £412,000 worth of the drug. Well, at least they were all staying indoors. And will be in the future, now that I think about it. Meanwhile, police in Miramar, Florida are still trying to identify a man who was caught on surveillance video ransacking Miramar High School on May 25th. The suspect spent 24 hours destroying computers, painting graffiti on the walls, and flooding areas of the school, all while stark naked, except for headphones. School officials put the cost of the damages at about $100,000. Now, I don't know about you, but while I'm only mildly curious as to where his clothes were and why he was buck naked, I'm really curious as to what he was listening to on his headsets. What do you think? Alice Cooper's School's Out? Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall? The soundtrack to Grease? Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It would appear that whenever we get to whatever our new normal will be after the COVID-19 crisis, some things might never come back. Things like the all-you-can-eat buffet restaurants. Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back. His site features a piece on the history of the buffet-styled restaurants. And Ernie joins us once again via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. So I read your piece on Tedium, and first of all, it sounds like you're someone who appreciates the buffet-style restaurant. I have always thought it was just a pandemic waiting to happen on its own, never mind an exterior pandemic. So tell us a little bit about the history, at least in the United States, the history of the buffet restaurant.
The buffet restaurant, it's basically one of those things that I think that most people, when they think about it, they think about it in terms of like restaurants like Golden Buffet or Ponderosa Steakhouse or Old Country Buffet. But it actually has some pretty deep roots in Las Vegas. Basically, in the 1940s, one of the early resorts in Vegas, the El Rancho Vegas Resort, they tried to offer a service to gamblers who were up late and needed something to eat. They basically put out like a bunch of meats, bunch of cheeses, and it really took off from there. And, you know, buffet culture, at least until now, has been pretty big in Vegas over the years.
But the difference, I would assume, with the buffet culture in Vegas, as opposed to the what we know as the all-you-can-eat restaurants, the Golden Corrals and the like, places that have a buffet, the difference is, in Vegas, they're basically a lost leader because people are there to gamble, right?
Yes, exactly. So, like, if you go to a buffet in Vegas, or if you did go to a buffet in Vegas, from what it sounds like, they're kind of assuming that like those aren't going to be opening up anytime soon. It's sort of focused on quality because they realize that like they're trying to attract people to the casino, so they basically focus on actually making the food higher quality, you know, like more exotic ingredients, you know, like things like king crab, you know, what have you. Whereas all you can eat buffet is sort of just cheap and, you know, like it's basically sustenance, you know, like put out in like, you know, metal pans, you know, through the restaurant.
Prison food.
That's a great way to put it.
So when did establishments, because as you say, this kind of started in Vegas and it was a loss leader situation. When did establishments take the Vegas platform and plop it onto a self-sustaining restaurant-style chain or outlet where this was all they did?
This is something that really picked up in the U.S. probably in the 60s and 70s. And from what I've seen through my research, like restaurants like Ponderosa Steakhouse and Golden Corral, they essentially picked up on this model. It wasn't like their original model, but they sort of fell into it. They tried it and they found it was very successful. So they started to build their businesses around it. These businesses have been, you know, they've had success over the years. You know, obviously Old Country Buffet and Ryan Steakhouse, a couple others, like they built fairly large chains throughout like the 90s and 2000s, hundreds of restaurants around the country for each of these locations.
Now, as you alluded to earlier, the difference between Vegas and the rest of the world where these places were self-sustaining was basically quality versus quantity. In other words, the self-sustaining places went for the cheapest they could in the bulkiest as they could in order to cut costs.
Yeah. And, you know, the way that I kind of described it is, you know, I compared it to eating bad pizza. Even bad pizza is kind of good. And I think that, you know, many buffet restaurants sort of applied that model to just about everything else. You know, if you kind of have the right salad ingredients, like you can still have it, you know, like it's not like it's inedible. It's just not like rising up to the occasion of a culinary experience, basically.
And I would assume that in addition to keeping costs down, both for the consumer and for the proprietor in the type of food that they're offering, there's also a slightly lower cost in not having as much wait staff, because essentially you have the patrons serving themselves as opposed to being served.
Yes, that's actually a big part of the reason why the model is very effective, because you're not having to like have like, you know, a ton of waitresses or, you know, or servers like you know, come to every table. I mean, like, you know, some restaurants, they may have like higher end dishes like steak, what have you, that may require some of that. But for the, you know, sort of the main star of the show, the buffet, it's a little bit more like, you know, you basically get what you want, you know, mix your tacos with your pizza and your rice, because, you know, why not? And just basically, you know, serve yourself and then bust your own plate.
Yeah. Now, there's another subculture besides the standalone restaurant that is an all-you-can-eat buffet-style serve-yourself. And that is the place that does have service to a certain degree, but offers an all-you-can-eat salad bar, which I like to refer to as E. coli Express. So, is that, like I said, just that a hybrid of the all-you-can-eat restaurants in general?
I think that they kind of, the basic concept kind of came up around the same time. I actually wrote about this separately a few years ago, and, you know, in DC or other cities, like, the salad bar is a little bit different there because it's not necessarily all you can eat. It's served a buffet style, but they actually weigh the platters before you buy them. So they're like, you know, so it's like you buy too much and it like costs you like $10-$12 just for like your lunch. And, whereas the buffet style, you know, it really depends, but I think that like it's that model kind of came up around the same time. It was kind of treated as kind of an amenity a little bit. But that model was actually easier to sort of translate to fast food. There are a number of restaurant chains, most notably Wendy's, that actually used the salad bar model pretty prominently in the 80s and 90s.
Now, it's a visual thing for me, and for me, it's out of sight, out of mind. You can go into a restaurant that is an all-you-can-eat buffet, and you will find a plethora of food very close to closing time. Now, a restaurant where you just sit down and you never see the kitchen, you have no idea how much food is back there. And I'm always thinking, when it's close to closing time, where is the food that has been sitting there? Where is that going? Is that going back in the kitchen, back in the fridge for tomorrow? Because that concerns me a lot.
Well, you know, one of the things about the model of buffets is that sort of there's a little bit of waste that's baked in. Basically, beyond like the serving process, you know, a lot of this stuff is prepped early on in the day. It's the kind of thing that they, you know, that they have like at the ready, that they can like put out like when they need, you know, like when it looks like the spaghetti's getting really low, you know, they can easily bring out another tray. But it, you know, fact of the matter is there is a lot of waste that kind of naturally comes with the model. Like they are throwing stuff out.
Are you, because you mentioned in the piece that you're a fan of the buffet. as a matter of fact, the last line, you know, I'm not giving anything away here. The last line of your story says, shed a tear for the chocolate fountain. And I often thought, well, again, that's just a bacteria waiting to happen. But do you think, seriously, we'll ever see anything remotely similar to a buffet ever again?
You know, with COVID-19, this is a once-in-a-century event. Obviously, despite the fact that, like, there have been previous pandemics in the history of the world, like, clearly that didn't stop the buffet model from originally building up. But, you know, I think that, like, it really depends on what happens with COVID. I will say this much. Like, one of the things that I sort of mentioned in the piece is I kind of consider myself a fan of the buffet from the perspective of it's a really easy way to get a lot of people together, like that you may not be able to at a traditional restaurant. Basically, because the cost is a bit lower than a traditional sit-down restaurant, it has the ability, especially for like families with lots of kids, to give them like a restaurant experience without necessarily making it like a $300 night. Mm. So I do think it's one of those things where it really depends on what the benefit of that culture really is. Yeah. And I don't know if that really outweighs the risk of disease. And it seems like, considering your thoughts on it, I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way right now.
Well, I think that they should just go full circle when they come back and start serving bat. Anyway, Ernie, it's always a delight to read your items on Tedium, and even better so to have a chance to talk to you about one of the items that you've written, as this was another excellent piece. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0564, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
When it comes to attempting to rob an establishment, many a perpetrator will don a mask of some sort. But as witness Candace Wendt lamented, why? Why would they do that? Well, Candace is stealing my thunder right now. The why and the that in question was the robbery of a convenience store in Louisa, Virginia. Two men walked into the store wearing masks. Not surgical masks, but hollowed out watermelons complete with eye holes. By the way, you can see a picture of these clowns who look like Dumb Donald from the Fat Albert cartoons up on our Stuff File program Facebook fan page. Anyway, the seedy duo allegedly stole alcohol and left. Melonhead Justin M. Rogers, who was about to celebrate his 21st birthday, is the only one identified by police so far. He was arrested, charged with wearing a mask while committing larceny, underage possession of alcohol, and alcohol theft. Police haven't found the second perp, though they believe they know who it is, so it's just a matter of time. Meanwhile, our witness, Candace, concluded her remarks this way. It's so stupid. Well, Candy, there's your why. Because, as you asked, why, oh why, would they do that? Why would they think that wearing carved-out watermelons on their head would be the perfect disguise? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0564. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0564. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?